Anyone who watches crime dramas could reasonably conclude that when someone is murdered, barring bizarre and extenuating circumstances, the case is solved. That is, through high-tech forensics, moral resolve, or simply the near-mythic competence of American law enforcement, killers are ultimately sent to jail. But as an investigative reporter who has worked in one of the most violent cities in the country for nearly 15 years, I can tell you, this is not true.
And that is the point of this podcast, because unsolved killings represent more than just statistics. It's a psychic toll of stories untold that infects an entire community. The final violent moments of a victim's life that remain shrouded in mystery.
I'm Stephen Janis.
I'm Taya Graham.
And we are investigative reporters who live in Baltimore City.
Welcome to the land of the unsolved. Welcome back to the Land of the Unsolved. I'm your host, Taya Graham, and today we will be reviewing a newly obtained report on one of the first cases we explored on this podcast, the mysterious death of Baltimore homicide detective Sean Suter. Suter, a veteran city cop, was investigating a homicide in the city's Harlem Park neighborhood when shots rang out. His partner found him lying on the ground, gravely injured from a gunshot wound to the head. Shortly after he was shot, then Police Commissioner Kevin Davis said Suter was the victim of a lone black male wearing a dark jacket with a white stripe. The department locked down the neighborhood for 6 days, outraging residents. But soon the narrative that Suter was the victim of foul play started to fall apart. A week after the shooting, Davis revealed Suter was set to testify before a federal grand jury just 1 day after he died. Details emerged that Suter was involved in a 2010 case where drugs were planted on a man who had been trying to evade Suter, along with the ringleader of the notorious Gun Trace Task Force, Wayne Jenkins. The Gun Trace Task Force was a specialized unit of crooked cops who were convicted of robbing residents, dealing drugs, and stealing overtime. But that connection between Suter and this corrupt unit led to doubts about what really happened on an abandoned lot in West Baltimore. And today, we have new information which may shed light on that question. Through a public information request, we have obtained a report from a separate probe into Suter's death conducted by the Maryland State Police. This overview has never before been made public. So I will be reading excerpts from the findings and discussing them with my co-hosts, Jane Miller and Stephen Janis. Thank you both so much for joining me. So first, Jane, can you give me a backstory on how you obtained this document, why you asked for it, and why this case still is so controversial?
Well, let's start with the last part of that first. Well, it's controversial because it's this heated debate. Was it homicide or was it suicide? And here we are in November of 2022. So now we're 5 years later. Incident occurred on November 15th, 2017. Now we're into 2022. And we still have not resolved once and for all, really, this question. I mean, there was an independent review board investigation of the case.
Right.
They concluded it was a self-inflicted gunshot wound. The coroner's ruling indicated homicide. It was definitely a homicide investigation. We decided, you know, 5 years later, well, let's see where we are on this case. So I filed a public information request with the Baltimore Police Department, State Attorney's Office, and the Maryland State Police. And the reason I filed with the Maryland State Police is because in 2019, the Maryland State Police agency was asked by Police Commissioner Michael Harrison to review the case, to review the investigation, to review the file, to see if there was any other, what conclusion they would have, if there were, you know, things that should have been done that weren't done, et cetera, to really review the investigation. And they issued a report to the Baltimore Police Department that has never been made public. And so we received it in response to that request.
Jane, something I think that's really important that was revealed in this is a revised timeline. And first, I'd like to read you a little excerpt from it, and then I'd like you to respond. This timeline, at best, leaves 8 seconds for Detective Souter to be engaged in a life and death struggle, be overpowered, lose control of his weapon, have the gun be pressed to his head and discharged, the gun then be placed beneath his body, the assailant disappear from the scene without being seen by Detective Bomenka, and then the assailant leave no physical evidence from the struggle. Maryland State Police investigators were in agreement that those events could not occur in 8 seconds, and that the actual time that Detective Souter was out of Detective Bomenka's sight was significantly less than the 8 seconds captured by the 910 Bennett Place video. So, Jane, you hear this revised timeline, and I think it reveals some new information here. What's your reaction to it?
Well, the Independent Review Board talked about this kind of very short time frame, 8, 9, 10 seconds. But this is a very specific reference and analysis. I would really call it an analysis. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you what they're talking about. So 910 Bennett Place is a house at the other end of the street, which had, there's video from that. And actually, there are some still photos of it were made public during the Independent Review Board investigation. But so they're using that video, and they're using the video of Bomenka and Bomenka's account. And, you know, he makes a phone call. So they have a time frame in there of a very limited time frame. And so this is an analysis of that information. And if you think in the time it takes me to speak 8 seconds or anybody to speak 8 seconds, there is a lot that has to go on in 8 seconds. That's what they're saying, is mm-hmm. that there's an awful lot that has to go on in 8 seconds for this to be something other than a self-inflicted gunshot wound. I think that is it significant about that? The significance of it is that this is yet another group of investigators that has looked at the evidence in this case and looked at the, you know, there's some additional information they looked at too that had not been yet made public, but and they're coming up with the same conclusion. So now we've got Independent Review Board that looked at the case and they come up with a conclusion of self-inflicted. Now we've got another law enforcement agency with investigators, homicide investigators, looking at it, and they come up with a similar conclusion. So that's kind of the dilemma that we're in this situation involving this particular case. This is obviously a high profile case. It's been highly politicized in many ways. It, you know, here we are 5 years later with really no difference. There's been no movement in this case. This report from the state police makes, as of 2019 at any rate, makes this very clear that they had never identified a plausible suspect.
You know, before I go any deeper into this incredible report, I have to ask you, what you said kind of begs the question, if this was ruled a homicide, but the Independent Review Board said that it was a suicide, the Maryland State Police analysis has found it a suicide. So where does it stand? If this is an open investigation, where do we go from here?
That's a very good question, Taya. That is the question. So when we filed the request that we got, the response we got to the request to the Baltimore Police Department and to the state's attorney's office was, it's an open and active investigation. Well, sure. It's, you know, we have a coroner's ruling that remains homicide. It was when this state police report was returned to the Baltimore Police Department. If you recall, Commissioner Michael Harrison of the Baltimore Police Department had indicated he really wanted to close the case. But then there was pressure. I believe there was a prosecutor at the time that was trying to run out a lead, said, no, there's still leads to be run out. There was a lot of pressure from the family not to close the case, as, you know, with kind of these lingering questions. So the case remained open. And then the commissioner made a statement that it does remain open. We are, it is a good question. What do you do with it? Where do we go with a case like this that has this very divided opinion on what happened? And with all of the information in front of us, it doesn't resolve the question.
So it seems to me that in this analysis, we're getting information that I haven't noticed was reported in the media previously, and that is some of the specifics surrounding Souter's death, the position of the gun, where the bullet was found. I believe this report says that the bullet was found in the ground and that the gunshot residue on the hand suggests that Souter may have shot himself on the right side and fallen down to his left side, and that two shots were fired from his gun earlier and that there was no evidence of a second gun present. What are some of the details that you found around Souter's death that were surprising to you here or that you hadn't seen reported before?
I think the one thing in this summary of the investigation that is done by the state police is that they are saying that he was probably already on the ground when the gun was fired. And the Independent Review Board investigation found that the bullet was found in the ground, like buried several inches into the ground. So it was a, you know, gunshot went in the right side of his head. They are surmising in this, in their review of the case, that he was laying on his left side when the gunshot was when the gun was fired.
So, Jane, thank you so much for that clarification. Stephen, I want you to jump in here. You've taken a look at this analysis. What stands out to you?
We were all talking about this before, and Jane can probably elaborate on this, but besides the fact, you know, that there seems to be, they recounted some of the evidence about his contact with members of the Gun Trace Task Force via text, which were later erased in his phone, and the fact that Jane and I were talking about before that his phone was actually in his desk when he was shot. But what also, Jane, and I don't know what you think about this, but the life insurance, which is mentioned just prior, well, it's not clear when the life insurance was purchased, but there is a very kind of cryptic reference to life insurance, which is partially blacked out. Jane, what does that say to you that they actually thought it was worthwhile to mention the life insurance? Because life insurance can sometimes be indicative of other plans or other things occurring behind the scenes in a murder investigation. What does that mean to you?
Well, this report is the first confirmation of a life insurance policy that had been purchased and paid out. And there's a paragraph that has redactions in it in the report that says that examination of Detective Souter's financials revealed the existence. The policy was paid out on December 15th, 2017. That is 1 month after his death. And it goes on to say, while the specific clauses, issue date, changes made to the policy, and other relevant information regarding the life insurance policy is currently not known, and this is coming from the report, it is understood that most life insurance policies have clauses that prevent payment for deaths resulting from suicide. Okay. So I think, what is the significance of this? The significance is just what the paragraph says. But also, it is the first time that there's been that this confirmation that there was a life insurance policy in place at the time of his death. The city in 2020 made a $900,000 workers' comp payment to his estate. So this would have been in addition to that and also preceded it. Tay, I think you made the point when we were talking about this, is that this was paid out before, well before, the Independent Review Board investigation, which obviously had the conclusion of a self-inflicted gunshot.
There's one thing I want to ask you, Jane, just from your experience in investigating these kind of things, and I'll turn the mic over to Taya, was that how could the state police not have access to the actual details of the life insurance policy? I mean, wouldn't they be able to issue a subpoena and get it? I mean, I think that would should have been clearer, but they seem to make it, I don't know what your interpretation of the language is, but it seems to me that they're saying we couldn't get all the information about his life insurance policy, and that strikes me as kind of odd. What
That's
do you
a
think?
Good question. I don't know, because really what they were tasked with doing was to really review the investigation.
So they weren't issuing their own subpoenas and conducting as if they were the primary investigators, is what you're saying, possibly surmising from that.
That is correct. I mean, they in their report do disclose information that had not been disclosed before, this
Absolutely.
Being one of them.
Yeah.
But they were really, their task was to look at the investigation that had already been conducted.
Right.
And to, you know, summarize their findings, do their own analysis of the evidence in the case, and to reach their own conclusions, which they did.
Right. And there were some interesting numbers in there about that inventory they did, right, about terms of search warrants?
Something Stephen alluded to was the number of investigations and interviews and tips that the Baltimore Police Department explored when they were doing the homicide investigation. So the review shows us that the BPT investigators conducted 123 interviews. They followed up on 54 tips and they executed 12 search and seizure warrants with no credible suspect ever being identified. So essentially, that's 123 interviews. Imagine being taken down to a police station, put into an interrogation room, and asked if you had anything to do with the murder of a police officer. These search and seizure warrants, of course, would be incredibly disruptive to someone's life. This shows me, and then on top of that, Harlem Park was cordoned off for 6 days, and essentially the Constitution was suspended for those residents. So reading this sort of disruption that was caused in our community, how do you respond to that? How do you respond to finding out that essentially they shook the community to try to find answers, and they still didn't get any?
You raise a really good point about, search warrants, execution of search warrants is very disruptive. Being hauled in for interviews about the death of a police officer is very disruptive. Tips? What were the tips?
That's a great question.
What were the tips? 54 tips?
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What were they? And where did they come from? I mean, who was providing some information that, probably resulted in, interviews and search warrants, et cetera? Those kinds of details do raise, you just kind of pile on the questions. There have been a lot of questions raised about the investigation of this case, the keeping the crime scene secure or keeping the scene of the shooting secure. All of that was raised before. And now we have these kinds of numbers attached to what was done in the investigation that does raise questions about the disruption that this caused. And who were the people that were so affected by it?
Well, Jane, just so people remember, because you were covering this pretty extensively, for the first 6 or 7 days before you started asking questions about Souter's pending testimony before a federal grand jury, the police department was really putting out the idea that this was a murder by someone from the community. And they were pretty heavy leaning in on that, which is kind of unusual for commanders most homicide detectives will say, don't say anything until you know. But they were leading really hard, right, from your recollection.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, and the Independent Review Board investigation really found fault with this, is the public information, the communications that was coming from the police department was what they described really as kind of misleading. As we look back on it now, it was clear, and if you talk to some of the detectives that were involved at that time, they knew it was clear that there were questions about whether this was a self-inflicted gunshot wound. But clearly the message that was coming from the police commissioner and the spokespeople for the police department was this was homicide. They kept talking about this, mysterious man with a black jacket. I interviewed people in West Baltimore, young black men in West Baltimore. They're getting pulled up, because of that description that circulated. And to this day, we don't know where that description came from.
Actually, I asked the current commissioner, Daryl D'Souza, at a press conference that question specifically. I said, where did it come from? Because I wrote a story about this for the Afro, and he had no answer. He said he'd get back to me, and I'm still waiting. So, no, they could not or never were able to identify, even if it came from Bomeka, they weren't sure. No one was ever able to answer that question, where that story came from, why it was circulated. I know Davis was the one who said it, but no one could tell me where Davis actually got that.
Something that's been brought up in this report that I think about often is that Detective Souter's role with the GTTF. In this report here, it says, quote, in January of 2018, an ATF agent identified only as JW met with Sergeant Lloyd of the BPT homicide. The agent informed Sergeant Lloyd that he had pertinent information regarding the federal Broken Boundaries investigation. The ATF agent indicated that the FBI had not accurately informed the BPD regarding the extent of Detective Souter's criminal activity uncovered during their investigation. The ATF agent specifically referenced Detective Souter's involvement in a 2010 incident during which Detective Souter recovered drugs from a vehicle that were illegally planted by Sergeant Jenkins. The incident followed a vehicle pursuit which resulted in a fatal accident. The agent indicated that federal investigators knew that Detective Souter was aware that the drugs had been planted in the vehicle when he recovered them and criminally charged the operator of the vehicle. The conviction was later overturned, and Sergeant Jenkins was indicted for a second time following Detective Souter's death for crimes relating to this incident. So, Stephen, how do you respond to this information and documentation of Souter's wrongdoings?
Well, I don't know how Jane feels about this, but what's stunning to me is this is almost a year after the initial investigation. So the FBI is supposedly relaying everything to Commissioner, then Commissioner Kevin Davis. And then a year later, an ATF agent wanders into homicide and says, hey, you guys have not been properly or correctly informed about Detective Souter's criminality. I mean, I'm just quoting the report. I'm not making any suggestions about his criminality. But to me, that's stunning that another branch of federal law enforcement walks in and says, you guys don't really know what's going on here. The FBI has been, I mean, Jane, does it seem like he's saying the FBI has been misleading?
I thought, actually, if I recall correctly, that was a concern raised during this, during the GTTF case, during the Souter case, et cetera, is that there wasn't a lot of sharing of information going on.
Which is just astounding to me, given that, you know, one of the main problems the community has said about Souter and about the whole GTTF is that the investigation kind of stopped at a certain level and never went up, and why wasn't anyone held accountable, and how can we trust this department? And that's why there's been so much, I guess, you know, distrust of the conclusions about Souter. So now we know that in 2018, another branch of the federal law enforcement walks in, wanders into homicide and says, hey guys, BTW, the FBI's not been telling you the truth, or not telling you the truth, but not giving you the full extent. Let's put it in the language that they use, the full extent of Souter's criminality. I mean, Jane, what do you think?
Well, the reason this is significant is because the theory of suicide very much involves his testimony and his role in the GTTF case. You know, the Maryland State Police report mentions that Souter had not told his family about his pending grand jury testimony.
Right.
So clearly there were, like, things, you know, really weighing on Detective Souter at this particular time because of that grand jury testimony.
Right. And he didn't know what they did or did not know about what he
had
done. Right.
And that, I think, is what is the important point, is he didn't know what they knew.
Exactly.
And what that part of this new report, or this newly disclosed report, tells you, kind of reinforces that. He didn't know what they knew.
And the point would be that if he went in front of a grand jury and they knew he'd done something and he lies about it, then he's in big trouble because that, you know, they could just charge him with perjury or lying. But, I mean, I think what I find sort of astounding, though, is that there is obviously a part of the federal, you know, law enforcement complex or whatever that was watching this and yet not saying anything, or you know, not communicating. I find that to be, in a case this explosive, I find that to be very strange, and you know, I think something that certainly justifies the community's lack of trust in some of the conclusions. Of course, it has nothing to do with the suicide, just the way the GTTF case went down, and the idea amongst a lot of people that there were higher ups who might have been involved or at least had knowledge of it. You know, so I guess that just shows you that, you know, law enforcement is not always transparent with each other, obviously.
And that was definitely, I think, a concern that I heard during that time. And you just, this does get to the whole issue of transparency and trust.
Right.
And the trust that, you know, you're getting the straight story from a police department. You know, the relationship between the feds and the police department during the Souter case was clearly, you know, strained, I would call it.
Right.
You know, the...
Yes.
Kevin Davis asked for the FBI to look at the case.
And they say no.
They said no. Right.
And then didn't they intimate that they had told Davis the day after the shooting that he was in front of a grand jury, and then Davis waited 6 or 7 days, and there was some controversy about that?
Yes.
Yeah. So there's a whole bunch of stuff going on behind the scenes in this particular case. But I just think that part of the report really struck me because, you know, as we talked about, we're not making any assumptions here. But, you know, Souter was given a hero's funeral. You know, the Baltimore Police Department played up you know, the funeral. And I remember T.J. Smith, the spokesperson, tweeting out the procession up 83. And there was a lot of hand-wringing about how the community had murdered Souter, and that, you know, this was an example of the community turning on the police department. And I think seeing these revelations come out later simply makes me question how police communicate with the community on things like this, and why they weren't more cautious about making any grandiose statements, but more importantly, why no one's really been held accountable for making those statements, which I think were misleading at best, but also kind of indicting the entire Harlem Park community and the people who live there, right? Am I getting this wrong?
No, that was obviously very much a part of the controversy about this case, was the reaction to it from, you know, locking down the neighborhood for the time that it was locked down, you know, like, just, you know, 123 interviews, 12 search warrants, and no credible suspect. If, you know, 54 tips... Who were they?
Right.
There's never been an accounting of this, I might add. This is the first time we've seen numbers attached to this kind of thing in this investigation, but we've never really had a full accounting of what went on in that first week of the investigation as it pertained to people in the community.
So, Jane, there's this really interesting reference to a meeting. Let me read this to you. Detective Souter was scheduled to attend a meeting with the U.S. attorneys prosecuting the corrupt BPD officers involved in the Broken Boundaries federal investigation on November 16, 2017, at 1100 hours. Following the meeting, Detective Souter was under subpoena to testify before a federal grand jury at 1300 hours. So this meeting, Jane, how do you react to that?
Well, that's when he was going to meet with the, you know, federal prosecutors to go over his testimony. And that next line in that paragraph is, you know, Detective Souter had not informed his coworkers or his family of the November 16th, 2017 meeting or subsequent grand jury testimony, which certainly is an interesting piece of information. And again, indicates, I think, the, you know, kind of his, would get to his state of mind and the concern, the very deep concern he had about, you know, what he was about to have to do.
Well, it also, like, so they were going to meet with him first and then he was going to testify, which says, you know, that either he had not really was not in a hostile position with the government. That's what's kind of confusing about this and why I thought it was worth bringing up, because he's going to meet with them and then they're going to subpoena him, or he's going to be under subpoena. That sounds very interesting to me. You know, whether maybe they were going to say, do you want to cooperate, or we're going to indict you, or, you know, that has all sorts of implications, which I think are kind of interesting. And I guess, you know, could suggest a multitude of things that might have happened to him at that point. But obviously, as you point out, Jane, the bottom line is it sort of, you know, was a jackpot for him, really.
Well, that's what I mean. He clearly was in a very difficult circumstance.
We see here in this report that Detective Souter's phone had deleted contacts, calls, and text logs, which revealed text messages between him and other officers of the Gun Trace Task Force who were later indicted, Officer Gondo and Officer Ward, and these were all deleted prior to their arrest. Now, these officers, Gondo and Ward, ultimately entered guilty pleas, and they offered testimony in the trials of Officer Herschel and Officer Taylor, who were also convicted by a federal jury. One thing that came out during the Herschel and Taylor trial is that Gondo testified that he began stealing while assigned to the VCID unit. He testified that his squad consisted of Souter, Ward, Ivory, and Edwards, and he testified that the detectives would routinely steal money and split it amongst themselves. And I can definitely see how this behavior would put one in a state of mind of fear for their career, fear for this coming out to the public, fear of how this would impact their family. So, Jane, you know a lot about this VCID unit that I have been referencing. Can you talk a little bit about what they are and what they do and the type of impact that they've had on our community?
Well, I think all you need to know about VCID is that in the Department of Justice report on the Baltimore Police Department and its, you know, discriminatory practices, et cetera, that was issued in 2016, VCID is frequently featured, and really the behavior of that unit was frequently cited as, you know, it's a very aggressive, abusive unit that was mostly focused on guns and drugs, It's kind of morphed into part, you know, like the GTTF was very much patterned after that kind of very aggressive policing. Jump out boys, as they called themselves.
Exactly.
And, you know, so and what's interesting here is that what Gondo testified to about the stealing, this was not the 2010 case of planting drugs. This was an additional allegation.
Yes.
Involving Souter's activities as a police officer. And it just gets to the point of he would not have known what they were going to talk to him about until he went to that meeting and until he, you know, was subpoenaed, et cetera. So, you know, there was no way for him, I think, to know at that point, you know, on November 15th, prior to the November 16th meeting, there was probably no way for him to know what was going to be talked about.
You know, but I wonder if he was communicating with people from VSET, if they were exchanging information about what they were hearing about the investigation or what, you know, they were thinking they might encounter. Because his testimony was going to come after, you know, Gondo had already been, well, wait, at that point, I'm trying to think. Yeah, Gondo had actually been, they had all been charged in March of 2017.
Right. And they had testified in other, had testified in other cases. They obviously testified about this in 2018.
Right.
But this was in
2017. So he might not have known exactly what they knew about him, but he did know that people he used to run around with were actually sitting in a jail cell.
Correct.
So probably he had some sense of that this was not going to, well, we can't say if it wasn't going to go well for him, but certainly it was something of tremendous concern about, you know, and just a couple thoughts about VSET, because I covered them a lot, and they were a aggressive police unit that basically had the power to go anywhere in the city. Now, usually the city is divided up in police districts, and if you have a unit going into a district, you're supposed to notify the commander. Well, these guys operated as a citywide unit that could go wherever there was violence or whatever, and pretty much, you know, I mean, I covered some arrests where they would just, I mean, they would just pull people out and do whatever they wanted with them. And they were extremely, to say they were aggressive is an understatement. I know a guy, I once interviewed a guy who wanted to join VSET because he said he was a former Marine. He said that's where the action is. What he meant was that, you know, it was very aggressive military style tactics. And to a certain extent, as you can see, the genesis of probably the idea of the GTTF, along with not just the aggressive tactics, but the let's help ourselves to the drug bounty as well. So it's pretty, that's a pretty interesting sort of intersection of all these people learning some really bad policing skills, I guess you could say.
So let me just read you an excerpt from the summary in this report. Based on our review of the investigative materials provided, the Maryland State Police Homicide Unit investigators believe that the gunshot wound sustained by Detective Sean Souter on November 15th, 2017 was self-inflicted. Investigators believe that the first two gunshots discharged from Detective Souter's weapon were fired in an attempt to create an illusion of confrontation to conceal the suicide. So once you hear that review summary, I'm very curious as to if this has altered the way you look at the case, or has it just confirmed what you knew all along?
Well, one thing it confirms is what the Independent Review Board also found, you know, concluded that it was self-inflicted. So it doesn't, there's nothing that the Maryland State Police investigators looked at that caused them to think differently. We are obviously, none of us is privy to what everything that's in the investigative file of the Baltimore Police Department about this case. I mean, obviously we were denied in a request to see that. So we're really relying on information that was gathered mostly by the Independent Review Board in 2018, because they had body-worn camera video, they had forensic test, you know, information. And so we're relying on the conclusions that are drawn by these other entities that investigated the case. But the bottom line is we are now 5 years away from Sean Souter's death, and we still have this very divided, I don't want to call it a conclusion because there is no conclusion, but very divided view about whether this was a homicide or a suicide. And we've had, you know, the police commissioner at the time has moved on. We've had different mayors. We have, you know, we're going to have a new state's attorney in this. So a lot of things have changed. But the status of this case and the posture of this case hasn't.
Jane, one thing that I think when I read this is that in a way Souter was like a missing connection between what many people thought might have been a gun trace task force case that quite could have been quite larger. Like, I feel like the unexplored aspects of his case are kind of why the community doesn't trust the conclusion that he committed suicide, simply because he was could have been sort of a link between the past and the present in the gun trace task force, and perhaps a broader look at the way the Baltimore police function and the way they do not hold their own officers accountable, or if there were people who really had knew and encouraged these kind of tactics and should have been held accountable. How do you feel about that idea? Because I just look at him and say, wow, if he had testified or they had done a more thorough investigation of him, they might have been able to connect some more dots, or maybe there was something purposeful there.
This is like the bottom line of this whole, that's right. We don't know what Sean Souter knew. We don't know what he may have said, what he may have testified to. We don't know. And you are absolutely right that it could have taken this investigation to a whole new level. It could have taken this investigation to additional directions, but we don't know what he knew.
Right. And therein lies why many people I spoke to while I was reporting on this thought that he was killed, because they feel like, okay, here's a witness and he ends up dead. How convenient is that? Now, we looked at the evidence and the evidence seems very strong that there's no suspect, whatever. I'm not suggesting that. I'm only saying I think that's why people have a lack of trust in the findings. Not that it's justified by the evidence, but it is somewhat, I think, rationalized by the fact that he could have been a critical missing witness in what went down with this horrible scandal.
Stephen, that's an excellent point, that the community understandably still has questions. Not only were many people's lives ripped apart and disrupted during the investigation for the killer of Sean Souter, but of course the medical examiner's office still has it ruled a homicide, and then he died right before he was going to testify, and who knows what he could have said, how many other officers he might have exposed to further investigation. So I think it's very understandable that the community has trust issues with the Baltimore Police Department for this reason, as well as a few others. So I just want to thank both you and Jane for joining me during this podcast. And thank you so much for getting this important review and summary from the Maryland State Police Department. We really appreciate it. We appreciate your analysis on it. Thank you, Jane. And thank you, Stephen. And thank you for joining us for The Land of the Unsolved and our latest update on the mysterious and controversial death of Sean Souter. I'd like to thank my co-host Stephen Janis and Jane Miller for joining me today. And if you'd like to support our podcast, consider buying one of our books on Amazon on crime and policing, Why Do We Kill? The Pathology of Murder in Baltimore, and You Can't Stop Murder, Truths About Policing in Baltimore and Beyond. And remember, if you have a case you want us to investigate, please send tips to landoftheunsolved@gmail.com. My name is Taya Graham, and I want to thank you for joining us for another episode of The Land of the Unsolved.